whole cow, and the black skin was shimmering damply in the last of the evening light. Rodario could pick out yellow and blue markings. It was wearing an iron chain around its neck, bearing an onyx pendant the size of a handcart. "Why aren't the catapults on the fortress firing?" He was worried now. The stony eyes had the gondola in their sights. Millennia looked down at the arrow slings, which seemed to be aimed straight at them. "It's because of us. We're in the line of fire, so we're giving the creature cover." "It can't be the dragon. No, it's certainly not Loa's brand," Koira stated. "Perhaps a small friend of his? Has he been sent out as an advance messenger?" Rodario could not make head or tail of the creature's appearance. He had never met the like in any of the sagas he was conversant with. "It's staring at me," he said, moving away from the window. "As if it really likes actors." "I'm sure it only eats good ones," Millennia teased him, aware once more that she was behaving like a silly girl in love, and that this was a highly unsuitable time for such behavior. "It's staring at all of us," said Koira. "To be honest, that's not much of a comfort." Rodario turned to the queen. "Can't you send some magic his way? Zap him on the ugly bonce." She refused. "We don't know yet what it wants. Perhaps it's a peace-loving creature." "In Girdlegard? Looking like that?" He watched, shuddering, as the creature dangled a blue tongue. "There! Do you see? It's getting up an appetite." Their gondola was two-thirds of the way across. The creature dropped down and spun round as it fell, spreading its horny wings to come gliding over to the gondola. It opened its mouth and showed a row of very sharp teeth. "I think it's making abundantly clear what it wants." Rodario sank down in front of Koira to beg, "Save us!" The queen did not need his plea. She collected the last remnants of her magic powers and sent a red lightning bolt through the window toward the swiftly approaching creature. Her attack hit home. The magic energy shattered the creature's face and part of its neck, and its flight ended in a series of erratic swoops as it entangled itself in the cables, holding the gondola aloft. Now the fortress soldiers could use their long-range ballistic weaponry. The cabin was suddenly jerked upwards with a clank, and then came the sound of ripping and tearing. Next moment, they were falling toward the lake. "Stop!" Rodario yelled, petrified, trying to grab hold of one of the supports. "Koira, do something! Brakes! We're falling!" The cable car turned, and Rodario caught sight of the injured creature following them, its talons at the ready. "Forget what I just said! Make it go quicker! Quicker now!" Rodario shouted, falling against Millennia and yelling in her ear, "The beast is nearly on us!" Tungdil was on the first fishing boat with Slynn, Balindar, Ireheart, and 10 of the Zadar, heading for Lake Pride with all sails set. They witnessed exactly what was happening 4 miles away. Slynn looked back at the small fleet of boats carrying the Black Squadron and the rest of the Zadar. The villagers had agreed to take the dwarves over to the island when they heard the names Tungdil and Boindil, and when the monster turned up, they put on an extra burst of speed. "Koira won't have any experience yet as a Maegar." "But I'm glad we've got a Maegar we can even consult," responded Balindar. "I was shocked to hear of the Queen's death." Boindil hopped impatiently from one foot to the other. He felt extremely uneasy, being on the lake, and had no wish to know how deep it was. Only the thinnest of planks separated him from the water. He wanted to start fighting, but how could he do that, stuck on this barge? He had not the faintest idea what kind of creature it was that was attacking the cable car. "What on earth is it? It's not a dragon," he said to Tungdil. "I'm trying to work out whether it's good or bad." Tungdil stared fixedly ahead and saw the red flash aimed at the creature. The dying monster was tangled in the cables. "Loa's brand won't have sent him. Dragons don't tolerate other monsters in their kingdom. He would have killed this creature himself if it had turned up in the Red Mountains." When the cable snapped and the car started to fall to the lake, Ironheart cursed out loud. Now we've lost that Maegar too. It's enough to drive you mad. The fortress in the lake was shooting tiny black clouds of arrows and spears.
She should be able to save herself. If she can't do that, she'd be no use to us against Lot Ionan either.
Tungdil sounded detached. The flying beast had tugged the cables away on both sides as it flapped its wings helplessly, cutting itself on the ropes. It screamed and reeled after the cabin as if it wanted to tear it apart.
Maybe the queen should start doing something, Ironheart sounded doubtful. They're about to crash.
At that moment, the monster completed a final erratic lurch through the air and disappeared headfirst into the open shaft, streaming with blood and spattering red on the walls.
Ah, that's what I call an unlucky turn of events.
Ironheart could see that the gondola had stopped mid-fall and was now swaying like a pendulum, swinging toward, then away from the pillar that supported Lake Pride Island.
Look, one of the ropes has held firm.
Tungdil grimaced.
I'd also prefer it if the Maegar actually did something. I'm not convinced of her competence.
Ironheart was about to say something when a mighty explosion occurred. A bright green column of fire erupted out of the shaft, blowing the whole construction up to the skies. The dwarves thought they could make out shapes of people, remnants of catapults, parts of the roof, some wooden beams and other bits and pieces hurtling through the air, driven by the force of the blast. The spectacle was accompanied by a whistling screech. The walls of the shaft glowed first red, then white from the extreme heat.
And then the waters around the area began to boil, and steam rose up in clouds.
Another blast. The flames died down, only to be replaced by a ball of light directly over the opening to the shaft. Below, far down on the bottom of the lake, there was a silvery flash, and a circle of shimmering fire spread out. The dwarves could see right down through it as it raced across the lake bed.
Ironheart thought he could feel a slight tingling when it went under their boat. The runes on Tungdil's armor shone out.
Immediately afterwards, there was a sound like a volcanic eruption. The lake surface started to shake. Waves swept against the keels of the boats, making them bob erratically. A third detonation shattered the walls of the shaft as if they had been made of brittle glass and not the toughest of steel. The lake waters streamed in, creating an undertow that dragged the fishing boats toward the island. The hole filled up, bubbling and raging, and then a column of water shot up as high as the palace itself before sinking again.
Hold tight,
was all that Tungdil said, as a powerful wave hurtled their way. He grabbed hold of the mast and hunched down, bracing himself.
I hate Elria,
growled Ironheart, finding a rope to cling to.
She always finds a way to ruin things for me when I go on a journey.
The rump of the boat rose up, surrounded by spray, and a huge breaker covered the dwarves with ice-cold lake water. Then they pitched down again. Their vessel shook and shuddered, but did not overturn. Slynn looked back over his shoulder. Not all of their party had fared so well. Two of the boats had foundered.
May Vrakas preserve them from Elria's wrath,
he prayed briefly, then set his gaze ahead. Steam still rose where the steel walls had been. A loud rumbling filled the air. The pillar on which the island rested was starting to crumble at one side. The basalt stone was breaking apart, and the island's equilibrium was lost. As the island toppled slowly to the left-hand side, the supporting column of rock snapped completely, and Lake Pride hit the water. A second massive wave rolled toward the boats. The fishermen were beside themselves with terror. Their little ship surged upwards once more on the crest of the wave. Tungdil stood at the mast, a picture of calm, as he scanned the tormented surface of the lake.
Well, scholar! Called Ironheart.
He steadied himself on the planks and leaned forward to counteract the movement of the boat.
Do you think there's any hope of survivors?
This second wave was much stronger than the first. Ironheart noted from the angle the boat took and the length of time it seemed suspended.
I'll never, ever go on a lake again. Never, ever.
He was dreading the pitching crash when the wave finally sent them plunging downward again. They were briefly horizontal before the bows pitched forward and they hurtled down the back of the wave. They were not far from where the shaft until very recently had been and where the island had stood.
Dwarf overboard! Came a shout behind him.
Balindar stood at the low railing and pointed to starboard.
Slynn's been hit by the breaker and dragged under.
Tungdil did not even turn round.
We have to look for the Maegar, he answered. We've enough dwarves. There's only one Maegar.
Ironheart stared at his friend, baffled by this cold-hearted attitude.
He's reverting to the Tungdil who came back to us from the Outer Lands with a reputation for horrific deeds of cruelty.
He saw some buoys on deck that the fishermen used to mark the location of their nets. They were made of pig's bladders filled with air, cork tree branches or glass balls encased in string. Ironheart grabbed four of them and ran over to Balindar.
Where is he?
Together, they stared out at the waves until the fifthling located the missing dwarf.
There! Cast it now!
Ironheart hurled the floats out, putting all his strength behind the throw so that they carried all the way to him. A spluttering, paddling Slynn grabbed hold of the rope tied to one of the floats and pulled it over, but he continued to sink due to the weight of his armor. He was fighting for his life, they could see. It was only when he managed to pull the other three floats over that he was able to keep his head above water. It was enough to enable him to breathe. Ironheart was relieved and went back to join Tungdil in the bows.
We've saved him. One of the other boats will pick him up.
Good. He stretched up to see more distinctly something he had caught sight of through the spray.
You might just as well have said I couldn't care less, scholar.
Ironheart said reproachfully.
That's what your tone of voice was saying.
Tungdil turned round suddenly, and for a blink of an eye, looked as if he were going to hit Boindil. His face was full of fury.
If I need a crossbowman, I'll find a new one. If I need a Maegar, what do I do then?
He countered the rebuke.
It's good that Slynn is safe. No more than that. Without Coira, our chances of prevailing against Lot Ionan are diminished. It'll make no difference not having Slynn with us. He won't have the kind of weapon that can kill a Maegar outright.
He looked at the fisherman and directed,
Hard to port!
Ironheart did not know what to say. This was a real blow. The boat slipped round and headed for some of the floating rubble. It was still rocking about and the lake had not yet settled. The fisherman reefed the sails to decrease their speed. He did not want to hold the boat. There were constant bumps and clanks as driftwood and flotsam collided with the hull. Tungdil had a boat hook in his hand, held like a harpoon.
Look out for survivors! If you see a woman, tell me at once. The others can pick up the men.
Ironheart lifted a net and stared out at the water.
A woman!
He called, pointing to a blonde girl in leather armor, motionless, face up, floating next to an empty barrel. Tungdil used the hook to pull her nearer, and the Zadar heaved her up over the side.
Is that the Maegar?
He asked the fisherman.
No, sir. The queen has black hair,
was the reply. Ironheart laid the girl down by the mast and quickly covered her with a blanket before Tungdil could think of chucking her overboard again. Her lips were blue and quivering.
That's good, he said reassuringly. You're alive.
She looked pretty tall and strong for a human.
A warrior girl, then.
One of the Zadar whistled and pointed to starboard. They changed course to head for what he had seen. Tungdil fished the next woman out of the lake. She was wearing a black robe and had long dark hair. She too was unconscious. And she wasn't breathing.
That's her,
whispered the frightened fisherman.
That's the queen! Elria must be merciful.
Elria? I'll show Elria!
Ironheart turned her over and trod on her back with his boots till the water gushed out of her mouth and she started to cough.
There! Hurrah! I am a born healer!
He helped the Maga to turn over and wrapped her in a new blanket.
You owe your life to Vrakus,
he told her kindly.
It felt more like the sole of a boot, she groaned.
Tungdil came over and looked down at her.
Welcome back to the land of the living, Koira Waitana, Queen of Wayan.
She coughed again and gave him a grateful nod.
This is High King Tungdil Golhand,
said Ironheart, introducing his friend first, then himself, and then the others on board.
We arrived just in time.
There was a splash next to the boat, and a man's hand was seen clamped to the railing. Then the second hand appeared, and a torso pulled itself up over the side. Brown hair was slapped tight to his head, and his aristocratic face was beardless.
I assume I'm allowed on board.
He looked at the assembled crowd in astonishment.
Well, I never. A sailing barge full of dwarfs.
By all the spirits of the dead.
Ironheart's eyebrows were raised in amazement, because he thought he was seeing the ghost of a man who had long since died. The clean-shaven ghost of a man.
Rodario?
Chapter 18. Girdlegard, former Queendom of Wayern, Lakeside, late winter, 6491st to 6492nd solar cycles. Nobody in the quiet hamlet of Lakeside could have dreamed that they might one day have the privilege of offering hospitality not only to their queen, but also to those illustrious dwarf heroes of cycles long past. Tungdil Goldhand and Boindil Doubleblade, the celebrated millennia of Ido, and a descendant of the fabled Rodario the Incredible. Not even the best storyteller in the village could have imagined such a company in their midst. The eminent visitors were gathered in the taproom of the Harborside Inn, drinking hot tea, mulled wine, or spiced beer. The villagers had withdrawn out of respect, and were pushing and shoving each other at the window and the doorway, trying to get a glimpse of the high personages. They sent in a few of their number to convey their best wishes or make presentations of gifts, but without a specific invitation, none of them dared to approach closer than 4 paces.
You're positive the magic source has been destroyed?
Tungdil addressed Koira, who was now wearing the simple garb of a fisherwoman and had wrapped herself in a blanket.
I realized straight away, she answered despondently. All the energy was released, and I managed to absorb some of it, but now it is dead. There is nothing left at all where the source used to be.
Ironheart thought back to the fizzing sensation, and how the runes on Tungdil's armor had started to glow. That must have been the reason. Magic had been set free into the air. Personally, he could have done without that experience, but the loss of the magic source would be a terrible significance for them all. Koira smiled at her subjects, even if she found it hard. None of this was their fault, and she did not want to disappoint anyone. She gestured to a little girl with a basket of gifts, accepted the presents graciously, and stroked the girl's blonde hair.
Thank you very much.
Curtsying prettily, the young girl hurried back to the others, waiting outside.
I simply can't think what kind of creature was responsible for Lake Pride's collapse and the destruction of the magic source, said Tungdil.
The Maga shook her head and gave her attention to the gifts she had been brought. There was a brooch made of fishbone, with an image of the island engraved on it. Sighing, she clasped it in her hand.
I think it must have been Lot Ionan.
Rodario the Seventh looked round the circle.
The Magus must have created that monster and sent it here, either to kill the Maga or to destroy her source of magic. Once it knew that it was dying, it threw itself down the shaft to carry out its mission.
He touched his throat. I saw quite clearly that it was wearing a chain with an onyx pendant. Perhaps that was the cause of the explosion.
Possibly, Koira nodded thoughtfully. Perhaps he put a spell in the stone. It must have been some very powerful sorcery to have an effect like that.
This brings us to a vital issue. Are you prepared to help us fight the Magus?
Tungdil looked at her searchingly.
More to the point, are you capable of helping us?
So you want to pursue the dragon first, and then go off to the south, she summarized. If we accept Rodario's idea, Lot Ionan won't have attacked me and the source for no reason. Sooner or later, he will attempt to conquer Girdlegard, and this act will have been the opening gambit for a takeover of Weyen. He knows I need the source to be able to put up any lasting resistance.
How much magic power were you able to absorb? Tungdil wanted to know.
Enough for now.
Koira sat up straight in her chair.
I'd need more if I were to campaign against Lot Ionan. That will be what you were asking, Tungdil Goldhand.
To be frank, I doubt you would be powerful enough to do anything to stop him.
Ihart listened as his friend deliberately provoked the young Magus.
Any minute now he'll be needing his armor.
But to his surprise, she responded with a friendly smile.
I know what you think of me. A young woman, hardly out of training, and one who's managed to bungle things so badly as to kill her own mother. But I assure you that I am spurred on by these drawbacks. Perhaps a warrior heart will be bestowed on me yet. She paused. I shall accompany you to the Red Mountains.
Your Majesty, objected Rodario.
To wage war on the dragon is...
Is an excellent decision, interjected Tungdil. I know why you wish to come with us. I've heard the rumors that there may be a further magic source in the Firstling's realm.
The same idea had just occurred to Ironheart. Goda had occasionally mentioned that merchants travelling from the west to trade with the Fourthlings had spoken of mysterious lights in the Red Mountains. She had deduced the lights might have a connection with magic. However, it had been no more than rumours and vague speculation.
Exactly. I will come with you and will collect as much magic source as I can. Then I can help you against the Magus.
Rodario raised his hand.
Permit me to speak. What assurance do we have that Lot Ionan hasn't sent more of these creatures up into the mountains or over to where the Alphar are? There's no guarantee, but Loisbrand can deal with them as easy as pie. I don't suppose the Alphar would be able to do the same, unless they've got Aetherton at their side, Tungdil replied.
Millennia had kept quiet throughout this exchange, limiting herself to furious glances at Hargerin Deathbringer. But she had held her tongue for the sake of peace. Ihart could tell she was finding it difficult. In her opinion, the Deathbringer had committed too many crimes in the name of the Alphar. Ihart had to admit she had a point.
I don't like the pact we've entered into with the Black Eyes. They've oppressed my people for so many cycles now, and suddenly it's all sweetness and light with Aetherton, and he's planning to lead the Alphar to their deaths and to destroy their empires?
Her mouth narrowed to a very thin smile.
I don't believe it.
Who says the Thirdlings are going to join us?
Rodario asked them to consider.
Right, one of their number has become High King. But don't they still despise the other dwarf tribes?
He glanced at Hargerin and Baskalin.
How can you remove my doubts for me?
Your doubts? Asked Hargerin in astonishment.
You're an actor. You're only sitting at this same table because you invited yourself. You have no part in decisions concerning the future existence of Girdlegard. You can't even fight. But I suppose we can take you along as a mascot.
Baskalin laughed in agreement. Now, a smile, dangerous enough to rival Tungdil's best, crept onto the actor's visage.
Try to strike me,
and you'll have to take back those words." Koira leaned over to speak to Millennia. "If I'm not mistaken, his face is looking much thinner." The Ido girl agreed. "And the lake has torn off a few beard hairs, I see." Looking more closely, she noted a distinct dark shadow round his chin, throat, and cheeks. "But they'll be growing back with a vengeance stronger than ever, I expect." The two girls exchanged glances, each reading the other's suspicions. In the meantime, Hargerin had got up from his seat and had planted himself in front of Rodario.
"You don't know what you've taken on."
"Yes, I do," he said confidently. "But it is not nice to fight in the presence of ladies. It would not be fitting to smear the place with your blood and guts while they are watching. And at the moment, we have a more pressing task."
"Stop it, both of you,"
Tungdil called impatiently.
"But I'm not being taken seriously merely because I appear on the stage. I can't accept that. My question was not stupid. I was wondering about the loyalty of the Thirdlings,"
Rodario returned.
"What if they decide to help the Alpha? They've served them for over 200 cycles. If there's a shift in the balance of power, they'll suffer great losses. Never mind that, they'll be exposed to the rage of the humans in Urgon, Idoslane, and Goregar. They'd be definitely better off if there's no change at the top."
"It's worth considering," Millennia agreed. In gratitude, Rodario sent her a long, warm look. Rodario placed his hands on the table.
"Can you understand why I'm hesitating here? What if the dwarf haters were to attack the Fourthlings and Fifthlings while they're marching south? We'd never manage a campaign against Lot Ionan after that."
"We follow Tungdil Goldhand," smoldered Hargerin.
"We? Do you mean all the Thirdlings, or a substantial majority?"
Rodario tried to pin him down to specifics. "It would be interesting to learn what the minority might get up to. And what about the Freelings? Where are they?"
Baskelin broke in.
"They've dug themselves in the last of their cities, and are fighting off the Thirdlings."
"Ah," said Rodario. "There you are, you see? The Thirdlings are still attacking the other tribes."
He folded his arms belligerently.
"I don't see, with all due respect, any change in their attitude."
"That will be because I haven't issued any commands to them to stop what they're doing."
All heads swiveled round to Tungdil.
"If the Thirdlings suddenly changed their tune, the Alphar would smell a rat. Then Aferton's plan would be jeopardized, and the Northern Alphar would be suspicious too. That's why I haven't told them to stop their attacks. I can't do that before Aferton has set out with his army. The Freelings will just have to bide their time and hold them off."
Nobody dared to respond. Finally, Ironheart cleared his throat.
"So, tomorrow we'll set off to Lohasbrand's hideout. We'll pinch his best bits of treasure and then hie ourselves off to the Magus. As soon as we hear from the Emperor of the Black Eyes, we'll send off some riders to order the Thirdlings and the other dwarf tribes to get to the south to capture a weakened Lot Ionan."
He looked at the Queen.
"With your help."
"Neatly summed up," commented Rodario. "I'm with you."
"Me too,"
said Millennia.
"Idislane will do its best to free Girdlegard just as it did under my ancestor. We can't provide an army, but I can fight for you. The rest of my resistance fighters will deal with any Alphar still at large. I'll write to them straight away. They will watch for a suitable opportunity."
"Good."
Tungdil seemed satisfied. Rodario put up his hand again.
"How would it be if we were to announce to the people, and not just to the resistance, that Girdlegard is about to be liberated? If we have supporters who have sniffed the wind of freedom and want to rise up against the Lohasbrander and the last vassals of the Alphar, they'll be unstoppable."
"Girdlegard's too big for that,"
Tungdil contradicted him.
"Somebody shoves something in that actor's mouth,"
preferably something sharp," murmured Hagarin.
Rodario pointed to his throat.
"If I had an ugly beard like yours, I'd be more careful who I insulted."
Eihart grimaced. Dwarves normally enjoyed a joke, even quite earthy ones, but you could not ridicule a dwarf's beard with impunity. Mockery and fire were the worst enemies of a beard.
"Stop that now if you want to get out of here with your life and fine features intact," he called to him quietly. "Apologize to him."
Hagarin had sprung up to confront the actor.
"You're just desperate for a beating, aren't you?" he yelled, waving his fists.
"Forgive me," said Rodario nicely to the two ladies. Then he shot out his foot, fished out the tip of the long beard in question, grabbed it with his right hand, and yanked. His left arm flew up, and his elbow crashed against the dwarf's forehead, making him gasp. Rodario slipped out of his seat without letting go of the beard, pulling Hagarin after him. He pushed his feet against the dwarf's stomach and overturned him so that he landed on his back on the wooden floor. The actor did a backwards somersault and ended up sitting on the dwarf's barrel chest, still holding the beard, which he pulled sharply to one side. Once he had anchored it under his foot, the dwarf was completely helpless. Eihart had been taken as much by surprise as all the others in the room. From somewhere or other, Rodario had pulled out a knife and was holding it at the dwarf's exposed neck. "I think it's a real shame that one is considered a true man only if one can either fight or go round grabbing all the women in sight," he breathed, but his eyes were hard and were watching for any movement his opponent might attempt.
"I've convinced you now, haven't I, Hagarin Deathbringer?"
Millennia's picture of the helpless failed actor disappeared in a puff of smoke, and Coira saw him in a totally new light. The women stared at him, wondering how this change could have been so sudden. It could only have been that the previous incarnation had been a deceit. Cool as a cucumber, Rodario let go of the beard, stood up, and offered Hagarin his hand. The thirdling got up without accepting any help. The shame had been too deeply felt, and his beard had suffered too. Eihart knew that the leader of the Black Squadron was never likely to forgive Rodario for this.
"Blood will be spilt."
"A charming interlude, indeed," commented Slynn happily.
"Tell us how an actor learns to fight like that,"
Tungdil challenged Rodario.
"And why you took so much trouble not to look like your forefather," added Coira.
"If I think of you with a beard and moustache, you're the spitting image of him."
"That's just what I said," mumbled Eihart. "As soon as I saw him clamber on board."
Rodario returned to his seat and bowed to the ladies.
"I must apologize to both of you, because I have been playing a part up till now. But now it is time to remove the veil from the secret of the unknown poet."
"You? You say that was you?"
Coira exclaimed, laughing in disbelief. She looked at him full of curiosity.
"You're having us on."
"Impossible," said Millennia at once.
"You?"
She stopped in confusion. Rodario bowed as if facing an adoring audience of theatre-goers.
"But yes, indeed, I am the unknown poet," he answered. "Who would ever have suspected me? Me, who resembled fabulous forefather Rodario so little, of being the freedom fighter and rabble-rouser, slayer of Loas Branders and their orcs. Deception provides the best protection, as always."
Eihart could not stop himself looking across at Tungdil when he heard these words, and he noted a sly smile playing round his friend's lips.
"Only coincidence," he fervently hoped.
Rodario stroked his prominent chin.
"I noticed very soon how similar my looks were to those of my famous ancestor.
On stage in Idus Lane, Tabane and Goregar, I never wore makeup. But when the performances were over, I would put on my disguise. He laughed, sitting down.
I made myself act the fool and lost the competitions on purpose, wanting to make sure nobody credited me with any intelligence.
Koira pictured him that night when they had met in the tower in Mifidania.
I really did have you down as a clumsy loser and clown, she said in surprise. And I bet you do know how to ride.
Well, yes, I do, Your Majesty, he replied. It was a role I was playing. And of course I do know how to swim, or I would never have survived the fall from the walls of the shaft.
A real hero, said Millennia with a grin. There we were, thinking the poor man was needing help, when all along he's a trained fighter, and a good one at that, as I've just seen.
Rodario winked at her.
Thank you. Must I say, Your Highness, to you?
She dismissed the thought with a gesture.
But that is only part of the truth, because there is not just the one unknown poet.
What are you going on about? Ironheart frowned. You just told us.
There isn't just the one.
Rodario raised his forefinger, smiling as he did so. The competition in Mifidania is a brilliant front for us all. The descendants of the incredible Rodario have been working for freedom ever since the dragon took over. Whether male or female, we have dedicated ourselves to the fight for liberty and have been working against the occupying powers wherever we go with our travelling theatres. We hang our poems on doors and walls and keep the thought of freedom alive in people's hearts. We can travel everywhere in Lohas Brand's conquered lands, and we fight the dragon with our own means. He took a gulp of wine. The competition serves the purpose of letting us exchange news, write new lines, make new plans. We're always ready to support the people against the vassals of the Scaly One as soon as the gods grant us an opportunity. We know their weaknesses, their habits, their secret camps, everything. He lifted his glass in salute and toasted Tungdil.
Thanks to you, Tungdil Goldhand, the opportunity has now arrived. The gods have sent you to us.
He drank to Tungdil's health, and the assembled company joined in the toast. Koira looked hard at him, eager questions on her lips.
Tell me, what really happened that evening at the tower?
Rodario laughed.
We freed the incomparable, but we forgot to take his valuables with us. There were a few very rare pieces, and I dared to return for them. When you found me, I had already collected them, and I handed them back to the incomparable Rodario in the alleyway without your seeing what I was up to.
He beamed at her and struck a pose.
Just like the incredible Rodario, Ironheart acknowledged. Add a little beard, and I'd be convinced he has survived the last 250 cycles, just like me.
The Queen nodded.
The death of this friend pained me very much, but luckily it escaped your notice, he went on. I knew the cause would continue to exist. Today I can see the fight was worth it.
And why did you accompany Koira when she escaped? Millennia wanted to know.
Did I get that bit right?
Well, there was a sudden opportunity to get to know the Maga slightly better, and to find out whether or not she could be won over to our cause, namely, to prepare for a rebellion. If I had got the impression that she was a devout little woman, I would have pushed off sharpish. Rodario bowed again. But I quickly realized that you were anything but submissive, so I stayed and observed you and how you acted. Increasingly, I realized that things would work out. He looked at the Ido girl.
When you and the Alf turned up, Millennia, the scales fell from my eyes. Gerdlegard was heading for freedom.
Or for ruin.
The first option I wanted to support, the second to prevent.
I see freedom coming, replied Koira warmly. Who would be able to resist this alliance of determined groups? He smiled at her.
Ireheart rubbed his hands in glee.
Excellent! We've got everything we need! If Rodario contacts his friends and Melenia gets in touch with hers, the storm can break. So we can concentrate entirely on the south now, scholar, can't we?
Tungdil rubbed his forehead and touched the scar. His brown eye stared rigidly into space. He did not seem to have been listening.
What about Sisseroth?
Baskelin wanted to know.
I know him. Among other things, he trained the Zadar, and he won't give up until he has avenged the death of his sister. If he realizes the Queen and Melenia are still alive, we'll have a dangerous elf on our tails, ready to pick us off one by one.
I'm sure he's more likely to hold back and wait for the dragon to attack, Hargerin said, disagreeing with him. I've known the Jonna clan for a very long time. They would do anything to preserve their city in the Jonbara from harm. We understand they intend to found a new Alfar Empire there. Sisseroth must think that Lohas Brand will be sending at least the scouting party out into the Alfar regions to investigate what has been happening on his own territory.
Baskelin thought about it.
That could be so.
And if Elria's having a good day, the Black Eyes could just have drowned in the tidal wave,
Ireheart chipped in cheerfully.
That's if he was anywhere near just now.
Suddenly, Tungdil's body convulsed. He sank with a moan onto the table holding his head. Blood oozed out between his fingers. The dwarves sprang up and pulled out their weapons, thinking there had been an attack. But Ireheart saw that the old scar on his friend's forehead had opened up.
Come on! Give me a hand! Let's get him up to his room,
he told Hargerin and Baskelin.
Shall I? Coira had risen. A healing spell?
No magic.
Boindil was emphatic on that score, not knowing how the armor would react.
It's an old wound. He must have hit his head back there on the ship and the scar has come open. I'll put in some stitches. We leave at sunup.
He left the company, and he and Hargerin and Baskelin carried Tungdil to bed through the taproom and up to the guest room at the back, where they laid him on the bed.
Thanks.
Ireheart sent the dwarfs away and waited until they had left the room. The door closed just in time. Tungdil opened his eyes suddenly, and Ireheart saw once more the mysterious vortex of colours round the black of the pupil. The open wound closed itself with a slight plop, and the facial bones moved gratingly, giving the dwarf a thinner countenance that reminded the horrified Ireheart much more of the way an elf would look.
By Vrakus,
he groaned, staggering back 2 paces and grabbing the handle of his crow's beak. It looked as if his friend were changing shape. Fine black lines appeared from under the golden eye patch, seeming to cut the face into segments. Drops of blood dripped out, then all the runes on the armor glowed, forcing Boindil to shut his eyes. When he could see again, his friend looked as he had done before he had swooned. There were no more wounds on his face. The scar had healed, and the black lines had gone. The familiar visage of old. Ireheart approached the bed carefully.
What shall I do with you, scholar?
He whispered, swallowing hard.
Whenever I think I can trust you, something happens to feed my suspicions.
He pulled a stool over and decided it would be better if he kept watch in the room that night. And he could not even say for sure whether it was to protect Tungdil or to protect their group from his influence. Girdlegard, former Queendom of Wayern, entrance to the Red Mountains, spring 6492nd solar cycle. Ireheart rode behind Tungdil with his eyes on the slopes of the Red Mountains. Even though he gave the impression of studying the landscape, he was thinking about that night when Tungdil had, for a time, undergone a short-lived change,
a frightening change. They had never spoken about it, and their company believed the fairy story about his having fainted.
What is wrong with him? Is it a demon inside him? Is it a curse he's under?
The chorus of doubters in Ironheart's head was singing fit to bust. On Tungdil's orders, they had taken the old path leading to a narrow valley that wound its way to a dark red mountain. Older memories rose up in Ironheart's mind as they approached the entrance. There were 5 bends in the valley, and in the old days the firstlings had erected strongholds here, thick defensive ramparts with gates secured by dwarf runes to keep their enemies out. The 2 of them had once fled here to escape from the Alfar Cintharas and Cathalor when they were looking for a firstling smith, and had found one in the shape of a dwarf woman, Belindis Steelfinger, now the fifthling's queen. The old buildings had gone. Today there were wooden palisades instead of walls. Behind the pointed stakes, he could see the glint of helmets and spears. Judging by their size, these would be orcs.
Up there,
Tungdil pointed at the red mountains,
is where the entrance used to be.
Not any more. It disappeared when the stronghold went. The dragon demolished everything that smacked of the firstlings. Rodario pointed to one side. Behind that heap of stones, there's said to be a huge cavern. It's a passage the Scaly One made for himself, and the Lohasbranders use it to get into the dwarves' cave system.
That will be the old emergency exit gate, Ironheart supposed.
He was occupied in trying to count the helmets he could see.
I think they've only got about 20 guards. Pig faces.
Why would they put any more here? Said Slynn, his eyes glued on the sky. Who would want to enter the lair of a dragon?
Dwarves, replied Ironheart briskly. Our ancestors drove off the dragons, and we'll be doing it again.
He looked at Tungdil.
You want us to ride into the valley in broad daylight?
No. The Zadar can show us what they've learned from the Alfar, he said, looking at Baskalin.
You take on the gates one after another. Don't open them until all the guards are dead. Find out how we can get inside without the dragon knowing.
If we want to empty his treasure hoard, wouldn't it be better if we slipped in without killing the guards? It will only draw attention to ourselves if we attack them, Rodario pointed out. Lohasbrand will act more swiftly then than we would like.
The orcs will die silently. It will be some time before their deaths are noticed.
Tungdil pointed to Hargerin.
We've been discussing the matter en route, and feel that we should split up as soon as we've plundered the hoard. The Zadar will go with us, and Hargerin will lead the Black Squadron. They'll take a different route to the south, and some of them will go off to the Dwarf Realms as messengers to request they send their armies, so that we can proceed against Lot Ionan. Others will ride to Aphaton.
He indicated Rodario.
And they'll take his letters to the descendants of the fabulous Rodario the Incredible.
It's a good thing we met up. We wouldn't have been able to scrape that many messengers together from our original numbers. I suppose they'll be reliable.
Ironheart was not upset to learn they would be losing the Desirers.
We'll rendezvous by the Blue Mountains, I suppose, he said.
Preparations should be finished by the middle of spring. Ours and the Emperor's. We can start then.
Tungdil glanced up at the imposing mountain glowing red in the light.
I still don't understand how we get away from Lohasbrand if, as they say, he can smell you from miles away.
Rodario was not satisfied yet.
And don't tell me I'm just an actor with no idea about warfare.
Millennia and Koira gave him silent support on this.
But that's what you are, said Hargerin contemptuously.
The dragon won't know at first what's happening. He'll think it's rebels, and he'll leave it to the orcs to put the insurgency down, that is, until he notices what's missing, explained Tungdil. By that time, we'll be halfway to Lot Ionan, at least. We'll have to ride all day and change horses when they tire.
Without that head start, we'll never make it. If he catches us, then...
He glanced over at Koira.
We'll have to kill Lohisbrand. But if that happens, we lose a vital element in our strategy to weaken Lot Ionan. If he gets too close, we'll attempt to drive him off.
You're putting a whole lot of responsibility my way, said the Queen, looking doubtful.
I am, because I have to. It's in battle we get our warrior hearts, not when we sit listening to tales about war.
He fixed his eye on her.
Come right out and say if you're too scared. Then I'll change the plan.
Koira's meager pride was hurt. Of course we'll manage to defeat the dragon, and the Magus too. By the time we arrive, Lot Ionan will be weak enough, so I, too, assume our strategy will succeed.
The sun disappeared behind the clouds, and the first raindrops fell noisily onto their metal armor. Tungdil turned his pony and rode away from the valley entrance.
There are caves over there. We'll make camp till the Zadar return and report the outcome of their mission.
They found shelter before the rain got heavier. Soon it was streaming down over the cave entrance. It washed away the last of the snow and removed any trace of the company's tracks. Dwarves and humans settled in the large cavern to rest before the attack they would be launching on the Lohisbranders and the Orcs. Ironheart saw to his pony and wandered around, observing the desirers. Hargerin was selecting his messengers so that they could leave at first light to take the news to Aetherton, the resistance fighters, and the dwarf tribes.
There's no stopping it now.
Then he went over to the Invisibles to see how the preparations were going for their night's work. They were sitting talking quietly with Baskalin. They had short beards all, were black from head to foot, and were heavily armed.
I really can't tell them apart. Do I dare to talk to them? He wondered. Who knows how many of them will return?
This thought did not arrive unprompted. The doubters in his head were demanding to know how many would return. Whoever knew the sign for controlling the scholar's armor and making it freeze would know more about the runes generally. It was important. He'd already decided how he would approach the subject. He waited until the Zadar had stopped talking, then went slowly nearer, taking care to ensure Baskalin was looking the other way, because he would be sure not to want his people talking to a secondling.
Talking? Being interrogated, more like. Might I have a closer look at your weaponry?
Ironheart asked the nearest of the warriors, who was sitting on the ground sharpening his dagger. He smiled and squatted down. That way he would not attract attention. The Zadar turned and looked up, puzzled.
Of course, he said, handing Ironheart the weapon. Do you lot like jokes? My favorite's the one about the orc and the dwarf. Really? I've never really got that one, replied the Zadar. Why would an orc ask one of us the way?
Ironheart was at a loss there.
But that's what makes it so funny.
Funny? I just think it's unlikely. Any greenskin knows that a dwarf would cut his head off.
He laughed.
And then there's the punchline, what the dwarf says and does. Very strange, but not funny.
Ah, said Ironheart, confused. Tastes differ, it seems.
He decided to change his tactics, away from the topic of jokes. He turned the dagger in his hands and admired the runes and the strength of the blade in order to flatter the Zadar.
What do these symbols mean?
The other dwarf explained patiently that the runes promised death to the enemy.
Just like us,
Ironheart said, a little clumsily.
I mean to say, you used to be like us.
He stopped short and handed the knife back. Now it was the Zadar's turn to grin.
What is it you want to know, Double Blade?
Is it so obvious?
Yes, you're an excellent warrior, but a terrible spy.
It's not really my thing. I like to do things more directly.
Ironheart laughed and sat down. He heard and felt his flask slip off his belt onto the cave floor. He drew a symbol on the floor similar to the rune that Tungdil bore on his armor. The Zadar said,
"You've seen it on the High King's armor. Frack told us he'd given Goldhand quite a shock."
"Frack?"
"The Zadar you came across in the Outer Lands."
"So, do you know the secret of the armor?"
"Is there one? Because it's magic?"
Ironheart nodded.
"Yes."
"It's not a secret. Any Magus or Maga, and anyone that knows a bit about magic will see it straight away on the High King. Or was it a particular sort of magic?"
The Zadar went back to sharpening his dagger.
"I'm not allowed to talk about it."
"But I must know.
If an elf casts a spell at Tungdil and locks him into the armor again, I've got to be able to unfreeze him without taking my crow's beak to him every time."
He found the black, almost empty eye sockets of his opposite number unsettling. It was hard to have a proper conversation with a dwarf whose eyes you could not read.
"You used your weapon to release him from the armor."
"Ha!" the dwarf laughed.
"It's a miracle your hands didn't explode."
"I was careful."
Ironheart was getting quite excited. He seemed to be close to solving a few puzzles. He glanced over at Baskalin and Tungdil. Both were busy.
"Tell me, please. The High King's life may depend on it."
"It probably will."
The Zadar put down his whetstone.
"Remember these words."
He uttered some sounds that Ironheart was not able to copy. Hurt, Boindel regarded the other dwarf, suddenly convinced that he was talking to the one he called the Troublemaker. His sounded like the Joker's voice.
"I can't say that."
"Then practice. For the High King's sake,"
he chortled, then stopped and swore, grimacing. The whole thing took only a couple of seconds, but it was enough to scare Ironheart into taking hold of his weapon. But the Zadar had calmed down.
"What else?"
"So they are really elf runes?"
"Yes. The ones on our armor are pure elf, but there are some on the High King's armor that I can't read,"
the Zadar admitted.
"It's obvious, but they've got something elf-like about them. And dwarf-like."
He saw Baskalin had just turned round and frowned.
"There's something I've got to do,"
he said, getting up.
"Hey, hang on, wait a moment. I knew all that. The explanation..."
Ironheart was disappointed but realized he was not going to get any more secrets out of the Zadar. But he'd been told the words needed to release the paralysis of the armor. He wondered how many commands there were to make his friend's armor perform other tricks, whether the wearer wanted to or otherwise.
"He really ought to take it off when we meet Lot Ionan in battle. I shall have to sell him the idea somehow,"
he decided. He reached for his flask and opened it without looking, while continuing to watch the Zadar company. They were working quietly, sharpening their weapons and exchanging the armor of the Black Squadron for their own. They kept stopping, closing their eyes, and seeming to pray before carrying on. Ironheart's lips were on the neck of the flask, and liquid sloshed into his mouth. He swallowed without paying attention. Then he noticed the foul taste, not a bit like the herbal tea he had filled his flask with. He spat the second mouthful onto the sandy floor of the cave. The liquid was a dull blackish red, viscous and slow to disperse.
"What's that?"
Ironheart looked at the flask.
"That's not mine."
His own still lay on the ground where it had fallen. Revolted by the taste, he spat again, then grabbed his own bottle and rinsed his mouth out. The metallic taste reminded him of blood and strong alcohol, and it stayed heavy on his tongue like pitch.
"Whose is this?"
he called out, holding up the flask after he had screwed the top back on. The Zadar he had been talking to came running up.
"It's mine," he said, annoyed. "I must have dropped it."
He grabbed hold of it as eagerly as if it contained one of Gerdligard's prime wines.
"What's it got in it?"
Zadar looked shocked.
"Why? You didn't drink any, did you?"
Something in his voice warned Ayaha.